We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us, and we're also happy to have back here on the program again David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at University of Illinois, and once a month on Friday, he's here on the program. We talk about investing in money management. He begins by making a few comments, and then you have questions about that or anything else that has to do with financial planning. He will do his best to help you out. You can call in, and if you want to talk specifically about your own case, he'll see if he can offer you some advice. So with that, we say good morning. Welcome back. Glad to have you here again.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. Well, there are a variety of topics we could talk about. Perhaps a very tough stock market, a very stubborn unemployment picture, turmoil abroad, and where in the world can we invest money? Should we be putting it under our mattress, perhaps? All of these questions are on everyone's minds. I'd like to begin by directing our attention to the congressional bills passed in both the Senate and the House, which address overhauling our financial and banking systems. More particularly, I'd like to focus on the proposed legislation regulating residential borrowers and their lenders. Both bills, of course, have to be hammered out in conference and then ultimately sent to the president for signature. Now, the legislation as proposed is really a first attempt, if you will, to address the collapse of the housing market. And, of course, our government has already poured in approximately $150 billion, that's B for billion, into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those, of course, are the two government-sponsored mortgage entities which buy mortgages directly from banks and mortgage brokers. Now, just a quick update on the U.S. housing crisis. It doesn't come as any surprise. You read the same headlines and follow the same tracks that I do. It's estimated that as many as 4.5 million homes are currently in foreclosure or will be in foreclosure during the next 12 months. That's an enormous amount of real estate inventory that is going to be coming on the U.S. markets and clearly is going to have an impact on prices. At least one in every five households that holds a mortgage is upside down. That is to say that the house today is actually worth less than the outstanding mortgage balance. Now, under the proposed legislation, buyers would not be able to be untruthful about their ability to pay back a loan, as buyers won't be able to secure a loan without producing genuine payroll stubs, bona fide tax returns, and other bona fide evidence of repayment capacity. Second, mortgage brokers, for the first time, will be precluded from earning a fee on high interest rate loans that offer borrowers an unusually low entry or teaser rate, only to be faced with a much higher adjusting rate down the road. Those mortgages are still available, and soon that will be shut off if the mortgage broker or the mortgage banker isn't going to make even a nickel on offering that kind of product. Now, rejected in the Senate version of the bill was the proposed requirement that buyers actually come to the closing table with some kind of down payment. And the senatorial suggestion was a minimum of 5% down payment. So if a house was $100,000, you came to the table with $5,000, but that didn't get very far. Also, neither the House bill nor the Senate bill overhauls or addresses some of the structural deficiencies of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. As we continue to pour billions of dollars into these entities in order for them to avoid default. Each calendar quarter, both of these entities continue to lose literally hundreds of millions and indeed billions of dollars. And naturally, both bills propose new agencies, thank goodness for that, or bureaus, for example, to oversee financial and sweeping reforms. So more regulation, more bureaucracy is around the corner. As I've told my students at the University of Illinois, if you don't have a position and you are graduating in finance, accounting, some area of business or the law, my suggestion is to hop on the nearest airplane, perhaps hitchhike out to Washington, D.C., and make yourself available for the next regulatory agency and or bureaucracy. That's one place where there are jobs. Now, I'd like to give some advice with respect to financing a residential purchase. And this advice may be more appropriate, perhaps, for the children or even the grandchildren of our listening audience. First, it makes good sense to have a reasonable down payment. And in my mind, that's 20% of the purchase price. With a 20% down payment, a borrower is at least assured of the best rates generally and avoids additional monthly costs like special mortgage insurance, which can be very, very expensive. If you don't have a substantial down payment, then wait and save your money. In fact, in many cases, it is indeed cheaper to rent than buy, largely due to the IRS standard deduction, which often makes itemizing mortgage interest and real estate taxes an illusion because it isn't as much as the standard deduction that's offered to us through IRS. For example, a single taxpayer, $5,700. That's a standard deduction. For a married couple, it's almost $11,500. That's a lot of mortgage interest and a lot of real estate taxes before the next dollar is going to be itemized. So in terms of what a borrower can truly afford, I would suggest that we return to the bygone era, if you will, to the original Fannie Mae guidelines of some 20 years ago that were thrown out when mortgages became based on credit scores rather than an individual's repayment capacity. Under the old guidelines, there were two basic rules. The first rule stated that a borrower should spend no more than 28% of gross monthly income on one's monthly mortgage payment, the monthly real estate taxes, and the monthly insurance. So let's take a simple example of a husband and wife. They're both working, and their combined gross monthly income is $7,000 a month. In other words, they're each employed at $3,500 a month, so their gross income before taxes is $7,000. We would simply take that $7,000 and multiply it times 28%, which equals about, call it $1,900, a little bit more, but let's just use $1,900 as a rounding number. And that is the absolute maximum dollar amount a borrower should spend monthly on their mortgage, their taxes, and their insurance. It's called the old 28% rule. Now, as there is a second Fannie Mae guideline rule, and one must meet both rules or guidelines, at least in the old days, to obtain a mortgage. The second rule states that a borrower should spend no more than 36% of their entire gross monthly income on the mortgage, the taxes, the insurance, plus any other monthly debt obligations like car payments, like student loans, like bank loans, credit cards, etc. So for our mythical $7,000 a month couple, we would multiply $7,000 times 36%, and that approximates about $2,500. In other words, $2,500 monthly is the maximum a borrower should spend on all of those items, all of the bank items, all of the student loan items, the car payments, the mortgage payments, the real estate taxes, and the insurance. Unfortunately, over the last 10-plus years, we tremendously loosened underwriting standards, and I use the word we because we are part of the government. We allowed this to happen. Borrowers, in fact, were spending more than 50% of their monthly incomes just on mortgages, just on real estate taxes, and credit card debt. Obviously, it doesn't take a Philadelphia lawyer or a college professor to figure out, or you to figure out, that that kind of spending is unsustainable. And, of course, we know the rest is history. Foreclosure flood is what we face. Now, I counsel my real estate students at the University of Illinois to scrupulously follow the 28 and 36% guidelines. It's sort of a foregone era, but I think that makes very good sense to determine how much you can really afford to borrow when purchasing a home. There is a huge difference between what we want and what we need. And what we need should be based upon these 28 and 36% rules. Okay, I've sermonized enough on that one. Finally, just a brief review of our couch potato portfolio, and my, what a volatile and tough month for the stock market. When I reported to you just a month ago on April 16th, our portfolio was ahead more than 10% year-to-date. As of last night's close, our portfolio is a negative 3.6%, and that compares to our benchmark S&P 500, which is also negative. It's down 3.2%. So the portfolios are sort of running neck and neck, but they've dropped over 13% in value just in the last 30 days. That gives you some idea of the volatility of mostly the European and emerging stock markets, and a little bit less volatile the U.S. markets. Of course, it's no secret that European and emerging markets have been pummeled in the last 2 weeks, losing an average of some 12% of their overall stock market value. At the same time, interestingly enough, U.S. small stocks and real estate investment trusts continue to show positive returns for the year. So it is important to stay diversified and have a proper asset allocation between stocks and fixed income investments. So there you have it, David. I guess I'd be delighted to tackle questions on issues that I've raised in my remarks, or certainly other financial planning questions on the minds of our listeners.
Okay. And if there are people who are listening who would like to ask questions, it's very easy. You can call us if you're in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have email. So you can send along your question that way to will-talk@illinois.edu. We have someone ready to go, and this is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm listening to you, and we're following all those rules on the mortgages stuff. So we're selling and then buying.
Good for you.
And so we have the difference from the sale versus what we're going to buy. We're going to have about over $100,000 to put down on the next house because we, paid and we didn't borrow equity and all that kind of stuff. So that represents about 37% of the down payment for the next house. Should we just go ahead and put all of that down, or should reserve some of it, say, for, a rainy day fund, which we don't really have established? What's typically the best way to go?
Okay, those are great questions. First of all, I presume that you had a gain on the sale of your last house. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay. And over the last 5 years, have you lived in that house at least two consecutive of the last 5 years?
Yes.
All right. So, and I presume that your gain is under $500,000 on the sale of that home.
Yes.
All right. So you have no taxable income on that gain. That's
right.
Number one.
Right.
So that's very, very good news. Number two, you're telling me that you have $100,000 as a result of that sale. Is that a fair statement?
Right.
All right.
That includes covering all the costs, realty fees, and
sure,
everything else.
Okay. Very, very good. And you have the opportunity to take that $100,000, and that could represent as much as 37% of the down payment.
Right.
So, in other words, you're going to be spending about $370,000 on your next home.
No, okay,
$300,000 on your next home?
The house is going to be $270,000.
Oh, $270,000.
So then $100,000 would represent
correct,
about
30%. Correct. You've corrected my math, exactly.
Okay.
About $270,000 on your next home. All right. And you're telling me also that you really don't have emergency funds set aside.
Yeah, we have some, but it doesn't. I think you have mentioned in the past that it should represent a certain amount.
It should. It should. You should look.
We don't have that much.
Okay, you should look at your monthly expenses.
Okay.
And somewhere between 3 and 6 months of monthly expenses should be set aside for a rainy day fund. So if your monthly expenses are $5,000, not your income.
Right.
I'm talking about your monthly expenses.
Yeah.
Then at least 3 times that and hopefully as much as 6 times that.
Okay.
And unfortunately, you need to park that in a money market account, a savings account, something that is liquid. And we all know that the interest rate that you're going to earn on that
is 0.2%.
Yeah, well, that's a good interest rate, practically. But don't put it under your mattress because it's not FDIC insured under your mattress.
Right.
All right? So you have to put it in some kind of federal institution which carries insurance.
Okay.
And then I would use the rest for the down payment. Make certain, of course, that that down payment is at least 20%.
Right.
Now, have you locked in a mortgage interest rate?
We did, 4.375.
That's a wonderful rate.
At 15 years.
At 15 years. So you are really going to bite the bullet. Good for you. And you are going to amortize this over 15 years.
Right.
And you will find very, very quickly that you're going to be paying down a very great and substantial amount of principal early in the game because it's amortizing over 15 years and at a very, very favorable interest rate. So you are doing everything right.
Well, that's what we did with this current house. So that we just said we're going to keep going. Let's do the same thing because it was so successful for us.
Yes, and you might as well continue a recipe of success.
Okay, so 3 to 6 months of monthly expenses, put that away.
Yes.
And then whatever's left should go down at least 20%.
At least 20%.
To go towards the next house.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. All right. Wonderful. Well, you're doing everything right. My congratulations.
Thanks for your help.
All right.
Thank you. And our guest this morning in this hour of focus is David Zinno. He's clinical professor of finance in the College of Business at U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. Once a month on a Friday, he's here and we talk about personal finance and money management, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, and I guess just real quick, given the fact that it's really, really sad that there are a lot of people who are upside down on their mortgages and there will be foreclosures, I guess. If you're looking for some bright light there, I guess it is that if people have good credit and that they are looking to buy a home, that this should be a good time.
It's a wonderful time. It's a wonderful time to buy if you have great credit and there are wonderful interest rates. Just a cautionary measure for people who are contemplating walking away from their home and allowing it to go into foreclosure. Okay. Obviously, it's going to affect your credit for a minimum of 7 years because that negative credit will follow you for 7 years on your credit history. That's one point. Number two, it may turn out that if you give the property back, the financial institution may come after you for personal liability, for the difference between what they sell the property for and what the outstanding mortgage balance is. So that needs to be determined up front whether or not there's going to be any personal liability. But the third negative, which most people don't understand, a lot of people who are facing foreclosure, and one of the reasons they're facing foreclosure is because they have refinanced the property once, twice, or three times and taken cash out of the property to support their other habits. To pay credit card debt, maybe to pay hospital bills, maybe to put a child through school. Some of the reasons, obviously, are very laudatory. But the bottom line is that IRS says, look, you had an original mortgage of $150,000. Then you went out and you refinanced it up to $200,000 and you took $50,000 out of that property. In other words, cash out. And now you're walking away. Well, we're going to treat that $50,000 that you're not paying back as forgiveness of debt, which is taxable as ordinary income. So, yes, you can walk away, But if you were one of those people who walked away and refinanced and took additional cash out, and you haven't repaid that cash that you took out, it is forgiveness of debt. It is taxable income. It's going to be appearing on your 1099, and you've got to report all of that income at your highest marginal rate. Hmm. This is impacting people all over the country who had no idea when they walked away from a foreclosed property. They thought they were finished with it, done with it. They had negotiated with the lender, no personal liability, and whoops, we now have a huge IRS tax bill. And one debt that you cannot expunge in bankruptcy are taxes. You can't expunge money that you owe to IRS. You can negotiate with them through a professional, but you can't literally expunge that debt. You can't expunge certain obligations that you have under property settlements if you get divorced, like alimony, like child support. So there are some things that don't go away, even in bankruptcy. And IRS, as we both know, never goes away.
Yeah. Well, again, if you have questions about financial planning, about your own particular situation, what it has to do investing, has to do with buying a home, has to do with planning for retirement, we do these programs once a month to create an opportunity for you to ask some really practical, specific questions. And then Dave, he'll do his best to give you his advice. And of course, we want you to think very carefully about all these decisions and don't just do something because Dave says to do it. You know, have this be part of your big basket of research that you're doing. But this is certainly a place that you can start. And Dave will try to help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And you may also email your comments to will-talk at illinois.edu. Let us go on here, and we will talk next with someone in Charleston, line four. Hello.
Hello. I am actually going to be talking to a financial planner later today because my mother, my elderly mother, has asked me to take over her finances. And she has about $180,000, and I'd like to have some advice about how to invest it conservatively because she's not getting very much of it from being in the bank. But I'm also like to do something socially responsible, and so I was wondering if you could advise me how to move in that direction.
Those are great questions, and actually they are tough questions. Now, my first question to you is, do you have a power of attorney?
Yes.
And you also have a health care power of attorney?
Yes.
All right. And how is the health of your elderly mother?
She is surprisingly good. She's 88, and her health is great. Her memory is going a bit, which is why she's asked me to move.
Okay. And let me ask you, does she live alone?
Yes.
And does she have any long-term care insurance in the event that she would need some kind of long-term care down the road?
She has some.
Okay.
But it's limited.
All right. So that $180,000, does she have other sources of income like Social Security or some type of pension income?
She has Social Security, and she has a stipend.
All right. So she does have monthly income, and I presume she has no debts.
No debts.
All right. And your question is how to conservatively invest the $180,000 and do something socially responsible.
Yes.
Okay.
Right now, I'd really like to avoid oil, if I could, and the oil industry. So, but I'm not sure how you go about doing it. I have, you know, my retirement is in TIA Crafts, so but I haven't gotten involved in doing much management because I haven't had that much funding of my own to manage. But so I just feel like a real newbie in this area.
Well, you're asking a very, very difficult question, is where does anyone put $180,000 conservatively? I was asked this question at least three or four times yesterday for fixed income investors. Here's my take on things. I really do not see interest rates moving up the rest of this year, and it would shock me. It would really surprise me if I see interest rates in the U.S. move up very much during the first 6 months of next year. So I'm thinking that over the next 12 months, we're not going to see a lot of movement in interest rates. That's great news if you are a borrower. It's terrible news if you are an investor looking to put $180,000 or $2.50 in some kind of investment. So one of the investments I really like at the moment are I like short-term Ginnie Mae bond funds. Ginnie Mae's are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. That's number one. So it's sort of like FDIC insurance. They pay a higher interest rate, and many of these mutual funds are very short term. They're 3 to 5 year Ginnie Mae bond funds, and they're paying at least 2 to 3% higher, if you will, than what you would earn down at the local financial institution. So I think a portion of the money, maybe as much as 25 to 30%, could be invested in a Ginnie Mae bond fund. Now, if you're going to work with a financial planner, I would urge you to make certain that you are in a mutual fund that is a no-load, no commission mutual fund. So, for example, a Vanguard or a Fidelity, where you can go direct and they are very, very low expense. So you can pay your financial planner on an hourly basis for advice, but you don't need to be paying your financial planner for commissions to place your assets. You can do that yourself. Next, I think that you can place a portion of it in a liquid money market account because you may, you never know when you'll need access overnight to money. Right. So a portion of it should be in a money market account. Then I think your planner could go out and shop for you certificates of deposit. These are called brokered certificates of deposit. They are FDIC insured. And you might put together a ladder, perhaps a 1 year, a 2 year, and a 3 year certificate of deposit so that you are earning some additional interest. And at the end of 1 year, when maybe interest rates might be going up, that money becomes liquid so you could roll that money into a higher interest rate. I'm a little concerned about investing in the stock market at 88 years of age. Hopefully your elderly mother will live another, 10, 20 years in good health, whatever. But it's difficult to, at that age, to suddenly commit to stocks, especially in a volatile stock market. And I'm guessing that she's conservative. I'm guessing you're conservative, and you wouldn't be terribly comfortable with that.
Well, not with her money.
Okay, not with her money. So yeah. I'm back to a combination of Ginnie Mae's or a Ginnie Mae fund and money market funds and then laddered certificates of deposit. That can all be done at very, very low expense ratio. And then you can pay your planner for, on an hourly basis for doing this for you.
Okay.
And in terms of socially responsible investing, I used to recommend the Illinois Housing Development Authority, which is a subdivision of the state of Illinois. And the IHDA is in the business of loaning money to local banks, and then the local banks make low interest rate mortgage loans to people who otherwise would not qualify for those mortgage loans. They pay the principal and interest back to the bank. The bank then pays it back to the Illinois Housing Development Authority. And you, as a bondholder of the Illinois Housing Development Authority, get your principal and interest as well. The advantage of owning those bonds is that the interest that you earn is tax exempt. It's a municipal bond. But I really have a difficult time recommending that at the moment, given the status of the state of Illinois.
Yes.
So if the state of Illinois turns around eventually and its credit rating reappears magically and it has a cash flow, then I think that's a very socially responsible way of investing.
Right. I should say she's in California.
Okay.
I'm in Illinois.
Ah, okay. So again, the same thing stands in California because of the California credit. So you have mentioned, or we're mentioning, the two worst credit-worthy states at the moment in the entire union, and that's California and Illinois. So, all right, good. I hope that helps.
Well, thank you. Good
All right.
advice.
Thank you. We are a little bit past our midpoint here with David Sinnoh. He is clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. Once a month on a Friday, he's here and we talk about money management, personal finance. We'll be happy to try to answer questions. And I have a couple of people here ready to go, and I have a couple of emails. We want to try to get them all in, and we want to try to answer people's questions. But again, folks can help us by trying to keep it brief. We'll go next to Champagne and line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, I have a question. I have some IRAs. I have some that are Roth, and then I have about $90,000 in a traditional IRA. And I was wondering, I know in 2010 there is a special deal where if you roll it over, you can spread out the tax payment over 2011 and 2012.
Correct.
And my question is, assuming that the future, because of where we're at now, that there will probably be higher taxes in 20 to 30 years when I'm ready to retire, that I'll be having to pay higher taxes on a traditional IRA, and also at the moment I'm unemployed. So on top of all that, is now a good time to roll that $90,000 over into a Roth IRA, or is it good when you retire to have some of your money in a Roth and some of it in a traditional?
Well, at least under the current rules, if you're retired, you certainly would rather have your money in a Roth IRA than a traditional, because the money that you have in a Roth is, first of all, not subject to any minimum distribution rules. So you don't have to take the money out at any time. And then number two, to the extent that you do take the money out, it's tax-free. So people who are retired are a lot happier with Roth IRAs than traditional IRAs. Now, let me understand that you are currently unemployed.
Yes.
So you are you in basically almost a zero tax bracket?
Pretty close.
Okay, pretty close. In other words, after you figured your standard deduction and your exemption, that you really are not paying very much tax.
Correct.
So you are an excellent candidate because you are young, if you're telling me that it's 25 or 30 years until retirement.
About 25 years.
You are an excellent candidate to roll traditional IRA money over to Roth and pay the tax. Now, a couple of things that are going to happen here. Most people don't understand that you don't have to roll all of your traditional IRA money into a Roth.
Okay.
You could roll
even
half of it.
Even if it's all in one account.
Even if it's all in one account. You could roll half of it, a third of it, a fourth of it, whatever.
Okay.
But remember, come 2011 and 2012, whatever you roll, that is going to be, you can either have it taxed this year, all right, which might be more sensible if you get a job, but you don't have to make that decision yet. Follow me? In other words, if you rolled, let's say you rolled $50,000 into a Roth this year and you stayed unemployed the rest of the year.
Right.
Well, you're probably never going to be in a lower tax bracket.
Okay.
So you might go ahead and just pay the tax and report it in the 2010 calendar year, as opposed to reporting half of it in 2011 and 2012. You follow me?
Right.
So you'll have a way of looking at it with a tax accountant, which I would urge you to do, to see where marginally you would save the most money. Something else, when you pay the tax, where's it going to come from? Is it going to come from pulling more money out of your IRA, or is it going to come from other savings that you have?
Yeah.
So that's an issue. That's an issue. It is always better to pay the taxes with money outside of the IRA if you are so situated, and that enables you to put more of the money inside the IRA. Understand?
Okay, say that.
Well, let's say you rolled $50,000 of your traditional into a Roth, and you reported it as income, and now you owe $10,000 of tax. Where's the tax going to come from? Is it going to come from more money out of your IRA?
Or is
it going to come from somewhere else?
Okay.
All right? So that's an issue that you need to look at, and you need to be at a computer with a tax accountant to see how to handle that.
Okay.
So that's important. But you are an excellent candidate, given your circumstance, and you're on the same page I am. I think taxes and rates are going to be higher down the road. So it would be advantageous to move some of that money, if not all of it, into a Roth.
Okay. And so in doing the calculations, are you saying that perhaps I should move some of it now and then maybe some of it later? I mean, because what you're saying to me is ultimately when I retire, I probably want it all in a Roth at that point.
Right. Now, remember that each year you can move money. You just don't get the advantage of reporting it over the two-year period of time. So each year you can move traditional money, and people don't understand this, into a Roth IRA. You could move $5,000 a year. You could move $10,000 a year, et cetera. And what you want to do is if you're in very, very low tax brackets, obviously move more of it.
Okay. And then how do you decide how much of it you should move? And that's where you're saying I should be with.
That's where you have to be with the tax accountant, because depending upon how much you move, given all of your other deductions, given all of your other income, then how much can you move with bumping up to the next marginal rate? You follow me?
Yes.
So each time that you move more money, you may be bumping into a different marginal rate.
And why would you want to pay those taxes out of other money as opposed to paying the taxes out of the IRA?
Because then you can have more money compounding for you in a tax-free environment.
Got it.
Would you rather have $10,000 down at the bank in a CD or $10,000 in a Roth IRA at the bank in a CD?
Right.
You'd rather be inside a tax-free compounding environment.
Okay.
Understand?
Yes.
Good. You've asked great questions.
Thank you very much.
All right,
very
my
good.
Pleasure.
Bye.
Let's go on again. And next up is Kankakee, line 3. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
How are you?
Good.
I have, first of all, I'm 68, and I have $100,000 in a traditional IRA, $10,000 in a Roth. I don't need any of the money. My wife and I also have some other investments. I've had it in a CD for the last year and a half. I took it out of the market and had it invested at 5% in a CD. CD's coming due. And
that's a handsome CD. Really?
Yes, it was. It was very nice. But
you should have called me so we could share.
Well, now I need to know what you might suggest in terms of. And I've heard the other callers. I didn't even think about converting the traditional into the Roth. But I am income that we have coming in. We're both retired, but we have about $100,000 a year in income, which is more than enough to live on. And our home is paid for, so we're just.
You're in great shape.
Well, we're fine, but I just. Curious as to advice you might have as to what to do with this $100,000. We are not we're not speculative. We don't like to get into things that are risky. We're conservative.
Okay, and you're in about a 28% marginal tax rate.
Yes.
So you're asking a couple of questions. One is, does it make any sense for you to roll from a traditional to a Roth, if any of it? That's one question that you're asking. And another question is, what do I do with this money, whether I roll or I don't roll? Is that
correct.
Sort of what you're asking?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Let me just ask a more personal question, and that is that since your wife is also retired, are you approximately the same age?
Yes.
All right. So just talking about life expectancies, assuming that you are both in good health, there is a 50% likelihood that one of you is going to live to at least 87. Okay. That's just the actuaries. So, and in fact, the most rapidly growing decile in the United States, interestingly enough, is 90 to 100. Not in terms of absolute numbers, but in terms of percentage. So if you're in good health today, the odds are that one of you may well live to 90 even. So you've got a substantial time horizon. The good news, obviously, is that you have no debts and you have a handsome retirement. So whether you place this money or some of it into a Roth is really sort of a tough question to answer. I'm sort of on the line in the fence about that, other than to say that if you moved money slowly into a Roth and you didn't bump up beyond your 28% tax bracket, that would seem to be a reasonable thing to do, right? Okay. Because pretty soon you're going to hit 70.5 and you're going to have to take minimum distributions. And those right. minimum distributions are going to be taxed at 28%. Follow that?
I do.
So at least you could anticipate and say, gee, if we have to take minimum distributions, now they're not a lot. On $100,000, it's 1/27th the first year. So it's $4,000 or $5,000. But again, when you start taking $4,000 or $5,000 every year and bumping it up into a 28% tax bracket, you might consider doing that today. And then you've put that money in a tax-free environment and you don't have to take the minimum distributions because you don't need the money. And then you can leave it for children, grandchildren, or charity.
Well, we were thinking of our charitable contributions are over that. And we were thinking when we do reach that 70.5?
Okay.
70.5.
Okay.
We would use it to make our charitable contribution.
That's fair, too. That's fair, too. And one thing that people often do is they take IRA money, which they have to report, and then they even buy charitable annuities. So if you are working with some type of charitable organization that you really, really like, then you might even look into the possibility of a charitable annuity where you are giving the money today, you're getting a tax break, but you are getting some income back on that charitable annuity. So that's something else to consider.
Yeah, we've been looking at that too, and we haven't made a decision on that, but we have looked at that. So what about the investment side? If we don't do anything for, say, a year, do you have any suggestions?
Well, if you want to be conservative, you're looking at fixed income.
Yep.
And I would not have a problem if you bought a 6, 12, and an 18-month laddered certificate of deposit.
Okay.
I chop them for the highest rates and see what happens. You're
okay.
not locking up your money very long. I think it's going to be probably at least 12 months, given where inflation is in this country, given the lack of factory utilization. I don't see interest rates jumping up dramatically. And banks are basically recapitalizing their balance sheet at our expense. That's what's really happening. The reason that we have such low interest rates as lenders, because when we put money in the bank, we're lending money to the bank, and they're paying us basically nothing. They're taking our money, and they're going out and buying longer-term treasuries or even shorter-term treasuries and working on an interest rate spread. They're not even loaning the money out to small businesses, for goodness sake. And this is enabling banks to recapitalize their balance sheets. And the government has made the decision that we are going to penalize or tax you and I by not paying us any interest on our money so that banks can recapitalize. That's really what's happening in America. So I hope this helps.
You've helped me a lot. Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Thank you. And one more caller here. This is someone in Urbana and line two. Hello.
Hello. Would you comment on the bailout packages that have occurred in the United States and currently in Greece? It seems like the taxpayer is again getting the shaft because the loaner and the loanee are not receiving a haircut on any of their loans, and therefore the taxpayer's on the hook.
Well, the taxpayer is definitely on the hook. There's no question about it. And the question is, what were the alternatives? What were the alternatives? Because if we do not have at least a reasonably viable financial institution, then we really are in even a bigger pickle. So it is important that banks can recapitalize their balance sheets. I'm not happy about it. It's costing you and I money directly in the form of lower interest rates, in the form of higher taxes, and bigger deficits that our children and our grandchildren are going to have to pay. It's an enormous problem, but we're sort of on the horns of a dilemma. If we don't allow the banks to recapitalize, then they don't have the money to loan, which means small businesses can't expand, can't hire people, And very, very frankly, about 75% of job creation in this country or more is the result of small businesses. And it seems to me that one of the reasons that we have 10% unemployment that's reported and more like 17 or 18% underemployment, if we really count it, is that small businesses have not expanded. And the reason they haven't expanded is because it's very, very tough for them to get loans. And the reason it's so tough to get loans is because banks don't really have the money and don't have the desire to loan. So are you and I happy about this? We're tremendously unhappy about it. I'm just not sure what the alternatives would have been. I'm just not an economist. And frankly, that question would be better directed to other economists and other people who know a whole lot more about it. Than certainly me. How do you feel about it?
I don't know. I don't think we got time for to go back to the caller because we just got a couple of minutes left. And, I have a couple of emails I want to try to get in.
Yes.
And one particular here, it's brief, but I think it's actually the caller is asking a fairly complicated question. He wants to know, you know, given where we are right now, would it be a good time to buy stocks, bonds, or euros?
That's a great question. I think it's a good time to dollar cost average into stocks. We've had from the top, now we're down about 13% intraday. It's a 13 or 14% correction. And I think a diversified portfolio, just like our couch potato portfolio, if you dollar cost averaged over the next 18 to 24 months into that portfolio, I think you would be happy. Now, obviously, you can't do that with all of your money. You've got to be very careful about your asset allocation. And right now, an intelligent and prudent asset allocation, it seems to me, would be no more than 40 to 50% of your overall liquid portfolio in equities or working towards that. In terms of euros, to buy euros right now, I think euros are still under pressure. And I think most people are still shorting euros. It's a great time to go and spend money in Europe because essentially your dollar is going to go another 15 to 20% further. And likewise in the UK, So the British pound is under pressure as well. So in terms of traveling, it's probably a good time. In terms of buying those denominated currencies, I think it's too early.
All right. Another question here, and you know, the listener sort of makes this observation that every day on radio, on television, on our air, elsewhere, there are market analysts. And they talk about the market and they make predictions about, is it going to go up? Is it going to go down? And they have various ways to explain that, to justify that, to say, OK, I can tell you why it did what it did. And I can tell you what it's going to do next week. And he's essentially asking the question, well, can anybody really do that?
And the answer is, I don't think so. I don't know anyone on the Fortune 500 wealthiest people in the world who are prognosticators about the market. Okay? If they actually knew so much about it, why in the world would they share it with us? So again, I can only tell you about my investment philosophy, and I think like a legacy investor, like a pension fund in perpetuity, like a charitable foundation in perpetuity, and that is that a portion over very, very long periods of time should be in a diversified portfolio of stocks and equities. Because the very, very long-term direction, not the next 1 month, 1 year, or even 5, 7, or 10 years, the long-term direction of equities still points up, in my view. But you've got to be a very, very patient investor. So I'm not one of these people who buys today and sells tomorrow. I'm just not one of those folks. I'm not smart enough to figure that out in time and be a prognosticator of the markets.
And just we were talking in the beginning about what was happening with real estate. And we talked about the fact that if you are looking to buy a home and you have good credit, this is a good time.
Wonderful time.
Now, you also said, though, you recommend that people be very conservative, that they make a reasonable down payment.
Yes.
And that they look at their potential monthly mortgage payment and all of their debts, and that they be very conservative when they decide how much they can afford.
Absolutely.
I guess one question I continue to have is, though, when you go to the bank and you give them all of your financial information, then they will say to you, all right, Mr. Sano, this is how much you can afford. Now, do you look at that and say, well, okay, maybe you think so. Are they still going to be pushing it up to the upper end of the envelope? And do you, as a borrower, still have to look at that and say, well, maybe you think I can afford that, but I don't think I can?
That's a great question, David. And what happens is that lenders use a matrix. And the most important part of that matrix is your credit score. Mm-hmm. It better be above 640. It should be above 680. And the higher, obviously, the more that you can borrow. So that's really the case. But again, I'm back to the old rules. What you want and what you need and what you can afford are obviously different things. Okay. So if you stick to the 2836, I think you are in good shape.
All right. Well, there we will wrap it up for this time around with our thanks to our guest, David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance in the College of Business here at the U of I, and he is here on the program with us once a month on a Friday.
Thank you so much.